Tape Ministries, Let the Tape Roll. This is Peter Chenseth on Friday with the topic Life for the World, John 3:14-21. And as we get rolling, I thought maybe I would repeat my commercial from the beginning of the week. Two of the books that I asked the bookstore to buy were, number one, The Community of the Beloved Disciple by Raymond E. Brown, The Life, Loves, and Hates of an Individual Church in the New Testament Times. How many of you have heard this commercial already? Oh, well, then I don't need to repeat it. I thought there were, you know, each day there are so many new people coming in, I thought I should repeat it. This is the book that Raymond Brown wrote, the so-called popularizing book after his 25 years of work on the Gospel of John, and after the many monographs and special studies, and then the two-volume Anchor Bible commentary. He did this about 10 years after the commentary. And then the book that I'm recommending now, but using more next week, is The Word Disclosed, John's Story and Narrative Preaching by Gail R. O'Day, which I have found in my teaching of John at the seminary just an extremely helpful book. There were 10 copies of each in the bookstore, and when I checked a couple days ago, there were about 6 left of Raymond Brown, and I think 8 or 9 of O'Day, so I haven't been selling them too rigorously yet. Again, just to set the this day in context, the 5 topics that I put together for this week were, number 1, life here and now. We looked at John 5:19-29, emphasizing particularly these two sayings with the red flag, truly, truly, I say to you. The first one, John 5:24, being truly, truly, I say to you, the one who believes has already passed from death to life, does not come into the judgment, but has already, here and now, eternal life. And then the next, right back to it, truly, truly, I say to you, this is 5:25, that the hour is coming and now is, when all who are in the grave shall hear the voice of the Son of God. And the point being that this second verse, probably from a redactor or rewriter, was harmonizing John's radical here and now notion of life with the more, in terms of the Christian tradition, traditional idea of looking forward to the moment of new life at the resurrection. So that was an interesting start, both in terms of John's realized eschatology, to use the technical term, and in terms of the struggle, even the theological struggle that has gone on in the making of John's gospel. Then the next day we dealt with the topic signs of life and began looking at the passage, or concentrated on the passage, John 2:1-11, the wedding at Cana, and reading that passage quite carefully, noticed that most of the great motifs of the gospel were already set in motion, like the first movement of the symphony in this passage 2:1-11. And then we looked at the signs in the book of signs, chapter 1:19-12:50, and came to the conclusion that not only are there signs there, windows onto reality, but the whole gospel, in a sense, is an invitation to see signs in life in terms of the great sign, which we'll talk about in the passage today again, the lifting up in glory on the cross of Jesus, God's sign for the world. Then, the last time we met, we looked at the Good Shepherd texts in John 10, and spent some time looking at or thinking about how artists have reflected on the Good Shepherd. And I mentioned in that session that the only time I've ever seen the shepherd in conflict pictured in art was this picture I came on to in one of the galleries in Europe of this shepherd crouched with a small dagger in his hand, facing a life-threatening lion, and back here the sheep. And I made the point that the conflict language, the struggle language, the fighting language of the texts on the Good Shepherd in John 10 seem not to have found their way very dramatically into either our art or our life. Now today we're going to face, with these texts and with this march through the Gospel of John, the struggle, the paradox, the ambiguous, conflicted statement that in John's Gospel, the world is both the object of God's love. Today we're going to be reading John 3:16 in context, and the world is also the death-dealing enemy. And how are we going to get this to hang together? And I want you to know that I've got no answers to that question. How are we going to get this to hang together? And I hope we can struggle in this session, as we did rather interestingly in the warm-up session, with that question, how do we get it to hang together? But first, I really want to do some, before we jump into the text, I want to pick up the motif or the discussion from last night, where we talked about, we read this, how many were here last night? So we had that experience in common. We read from John 8 the extremely, I used the term vicious, and I guess I'll use it again, passionate, conflicted, even hate-filled exchange between Jesus and the Jews, and we tried to put that into context. And I guess I want to jump off by reminding us that in the sweep of the gospel, you have the coming to clarity dramatically of the fact that the Jews are, the term the Jews comes to designate those people, particularly the leaders of Judaism, who have said no to Jesus. And then the word world tends to develop in the movement of John's Gospel to mean those people who have rejected Jesus, who say no to the light of the world. So it's almost valid to put an equation mark between these two. Now what I want to do is just go through this and remind you that most scholars find the structure of the whole of John's Gospel a rather simple, easy structure. You have the prologue, John 1:1 to 18, and in this warm-up session before we get to John 3:14-21. I want to read a section from the prologue. Then you have the body of the first part, 1:19-12:50, the book of signs. And that's where we have, I am the light of the world, Jesus saying after the opening of the eyes of the man born blind. Chapter 6, I am the bread of life. And we're going to talk about that next week. It probably is not immediately related to Eucharistic language, but very related in a very complex way to Eucharistic language. Then you have the raising of Lazarus and Jesus saying, I am the way, the truth, and the life. All these signs. And in that section, during that section, you have the movement of Jesus toward the world and toward the Jews, and the reaction, as we saw last night in chapter 8, of these people against him to actively reject him. That's the way John tells the story here. And then, in the last section, the Book of Glory, which goes from 13:1 to 20:31 in the analysis of most scholars, you have Jesus moving away from this encounter with the world and the Jews to concentrating on the beloved community. So you have here in 13:1 following the text of the foot washing, which is unique to John. At the end of that particular section, last discourses or conversations, you have the high priestly prayer, and we want to look at some of the interesting tensions within that high priestly prayer. And then the second section of the Book of Glory, you have the cross and resurrection, 18:1, 20:30-31. And there are signs in there or indications in there that the scholars are right when they say from here on in the emphasis is not reaching out to the world and to the Jews so much as the emphasis is on strengthening and encouraging and then finally sending out, we'll see that again, the beloved community. Now, in this section here is very interesting, just to give you an indication of how the scholars seem to be right when they say the emphasis in the cross and resurrection is not immediately on the mission out to the world, but more immediately on the strengthening of the beloved community. There are, in the gospel tradition, seven words from the cross. How many have ever been to a service on the seven last words? Most of the services that deal with the seven last words of Jesus from the cross assume what we talked about earlier, the harmonization of the gospel, as though all seven we're on the same level. The interesting thing is when you look at it, there is one word from the cross, one alone, in Mark and Matthew. And what is it? My God, why have you forsaken me? That's the only word from the cross there. There are three that are unique each to Luke and John. Neither Luke nor John feels he can make sense out of Jesus' death with the cry of dereliction, my God, why have you forsaken me? Luke has three words from the cross. Some of them, even called into question by the manuscript tradition, whether they were there in the first place. but there's a consistent theology about Jesus' death in Luke's gospel. The first word, remember? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. The next word in Luke is to the repentant thief on the cross, today you will be with me in paradise. And then the third word from the cross in Luke is, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And if you, we're not going to get lost in this, but it's very interesting that as compared with the cry of abandonment, total loneliness, dereliction, almost anger against God. My God, why have you forsaken me? In the Mark and Matthean tradition, you have in Luke, Jesus totally in control, really. Totally in control. From the cross saying, forgive them, the ones who are doing it, saying to a repentant cross, as though he were not at all out of, Jesus were not at all out of power, today you will be with me in paradise, and then finally graciously returning his spirit to the Father. John's words from the cross reflect a slightly different theology, and that's the point of this ramble through the seven last words. It is not, Father, forgive them, but what's the first one? I thirst. And the next one, very clearly touching on the beloved community. Woman, behold your son, behold your mother. And of course, Roman Catholic interpretation of this says Mary, of course, is the symbol for the church. And so establishing from the very cross the beloved community, which will continue, and then the last word from the cross, it is finished. And I only went through this to say that there is some justification in the scholarly analysis which says that in John's gospel, in this whole second book, the Book of Glory, there is a movement away from the signs into the world, calling the Jews and the world, the immediate context and the far out context, to see Jesus as the life of the world. There's a movement away from that to building the beloved community. Now that is, like everything else in John, too simplistic. Remember, John is, I haven't said this in this group before, but it's a beautiful thing to have said, and it's a valid thing to have said about John. John is a book in which a child can wade or an elephant can swim. In which a child can wade or an elephant can swim, because it is so incredibly simple on the surface. And the depths, you don't know how deep it goes. It's probably as deep as Lake Chelan, way down there. So I like that. So now, that was my survey of the general pattern of John's statements about the world. Now I'd like to go into our text for a while, and do that in three sections. John 3, 14 through 21. Well, maybe I could, since so many of you were here last night, set this up a little bit by repeating the two quotations from Brown that I read last night. Where Brown said, John is not anti-Semitic. The evangelist is condemning not race nor people, but condemning opposition to Jesus. And on the same page, I read this last night, unlike the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, John does not attack the Pharisees, and most often the Pharisees and the Jews can be equated, the leadership of the Jews, for hypocrisy, and that happens, the condemning of the Pharisees in Matthew and Mark and Luke for hypocrisy is very strong, nor does John condemn them on their moral or social behavior. The whole attack, and attack it is, centers on their refusal to believe in Jesus and on their desire to kill him. Now the topic for today, for which I have no easy answers, and probably no easy answers exist, how do we live in the tension and the struggle we're going to find here deepened and concretized in the texts, that the world is the object of God's love and the world is the enemy. The enemy. Okay, now let's jump into the text. Will somebody read John 3:14?
Great. Moses,
okay.
And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him may have eternal life.
Okay, at the very beginning, at the kickoff for the famous gospel in a nugget, John 3:16, you have the great sign raised up. Even as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And we worked on that one quite articulately and in some detail on the day we discussed signs. Now, will somebody else read verses 16 through 18 and then pause at the end of 18?
For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. For God sent the Son into the world, not to condemn the world, but that the world might be saved through him.
Okay, now this is very, very, very clear. Not to condemn the world, but to save the world. Maybe one of the questions we have to let operate as we read these things is, how is the world, that whole outside force that is so extremely powerful in our lives, how is this world to be saved in terms of the complexity of Johannine theology at this point? Now let's read the downside of this. And did you read 18 too?
No, I didn't.
Read that.
He who believes in him is not condemned. He who does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only Son of God.
Here we have another example of Johannine realized eschatology, echoing that the one who believes has already passed from death to life, and the opposite here seems to be suggested. Those who reject have already passed from life to death. Now the other passage, 19 to 21.
And this is the judgment, that the light has come into the world, and people love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For all who do evil hate the light and do not come to the light, so that their deeds may not be exposed. But those who do what is true come to the light, so that it may be clearly seen that their deeds have been done in God.
Which translation is that?
That's the New Revised.
That's very good. They've done a good job on the pronouns. That's the New Revised. Okay. But here you pick up one of John's great themes, light, and the ambivalence of all people, as it were, against the light. Those who said yes to the great sign don't fear the light. In fact, they welcome it because their deeds will be revealed as deeds of obedience. But the world hates the light, because the light reveals something about the world that the world does not want to face. Now this sets it up, and I guess my plan for today is, after we've looked at some passages that are reflecting or that reflect the struggle, I want to come back and ask us in discussion to think about how it works. How do I, when I, it's interesting this morning, Don Pieper's devotions is a kind of, I think, where we all live in Holden. Okay, here it seems so clear. Here it seems so clear. When you get back to the battle, and the battle is also here, of course, inside, but when you get back to the battle, how does it work? How can the world, how can I live out the fact as an articulate and self-conscious Christian that the world is the object of God's love and God's sending of God's Son, and the reason for the cross being set up, the love and the saving of the world. How can I live with that fact at the same time that I live with the fact that the world is the enemy, the death-dealing enemy? Yes, sir.
To change the subject for just a second, last night you spoke or gave many examples of how John tends to attack the Jews. Wouldn't verse 14 kind of be an implicit acknowledgement of the leadership of the Jews in the search for God? I mean, he's upholding Moses as the person who had held up the...
Absolutely, we're back to the ambivalence, or that's not even a strong enough word. We're back to the very meaning. John isn't telling the story of Jesus without lifting up the validity of the whole Jewish tradition.
Exactly.
Yeah, but that doesn't change the fact at all that in John you have the. I can't ever get the right word. The dramatic, I used last night, the vicious confrontation between one understanding of Judaism and another. You can't get by that. That's what I guess the point I'm trying to make for myself and for us to discuss is life is in the struggle. Somehow out of that clash has to come our understanding of the new life, that the struggle that we are invited into. That's why I echo what Phyllis said sitting in that chair last night. What we did last night was life. That was moving into their pain, our pain, God's pain, and saying in faith, something has to come out of this that can validly be called new life, resurrection life. And it's never simple, never easy, and never without pain. Yes, sir.
Doesn't John pretty well define that, however, in his high priestly prayer?
That's what I want. I've got about seven passages I want to read before we jump back into this passage and into our discussion. So let's, if that's all right, let's do that, running through the rest of the gospel sort of barefooted, reading. And we're not just doing proof texting or just pulling out of context, because I think we've set the context. But the passages I'm going to ask us to read lightning quick so we can get to more discussion is our passages which illustrate one side or the other of this struggle, that the world is both the object of God's Son-giving, life-giving love, and the world is the enemy. Okay, let's try 1248. Somebody start with 47, just to give it a little run.
If anyone hears my sayings and does not keep them, I did not judge him, for I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world.
There we have it again. Okay, go on.
He who rejects me and does not receive my sayings has a judge. The word that I have spoken will be his judge on the last day.
So back to back again we have, I didn't come to judge, but judgment is a reality. Said with passion. Next one, 14:17. Give us 15, 16, and 17.
If you love me, you will obey my commandments. I will ask the Father, and he will give you another helper, who will stay with you forever. He is the Spirit who reveals the truth about God. The world cannot receive
him. Whom the world cannot receive. That's another hard saying, okay?
Because it cannot see him or know him. But you know him because he remains with you as in you.
Okay, now the next passage, which gets worse. You can always find something worse in your mind. And this, like last night, 15.
These things I have spoken unto you, that in me ye might have peace. In the world ye shall have tribulation. But be of good cheer, I have overcome the world.
And what does that mean? In what sense has Jesus overcome the world? Now we're going into our high priestly prayer, and just run through them. That's the climax of this whole section. After these last conversations, only in John, and you could argue that that's the only. You could argue that in John, the foot washing is the only sacrament. That's an interesting thing to ponder on. At the end of this interesting section on the last conversations, you have chapter 17, the so-called high priestly prayer, 17:1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, Father, the hour has come. Glorify the Son, that the Son may glorify these, since thou hast given him power over all flesh to give eternal life to all whom thou hast given him. And you, those of you who have followed the ecumenical movement in the last 40 years, know that the more sermons have been given on ecumenical Sundays, on Sundays celebrating the unity of the Church, and more sermons have been given on John 17 than almost any other text. So let's just run through the high priestly prayer quickly in terms of the motif, the world. 17:6. Anybody?
I have manifested thy name to the people whom thou gavest me out of the world. Thine they were, and thou gavest them to me, and they have kept thy word.
Okay, now here you have a perfect example of what the scholars say. Here in the Book of Glory, the concentration is on the beloved community. Who is the beloved community? People that have been snatched out of the world. Next one, 17:9.
I pray for them. I do not pray for the world.
I do not pray for the world. What kind of business is that? Okay.
But for the ones you have given me, because they are yours. And everything of mine is yours, and everything of yours is mine. And I have been glorified in them.
And I am glorified in them. And what does glory mean in John's Gospel? 17:14.
I have given them thy word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world.
Okay, I am not of the world. And the world, there again the motif of hate. Okay, 17:18.
As thou hast sent me into the world, even so I have also sent them into the world.
Okay, there you have the other side. God so loved the world that God sent God's only Son into the world, and even here, even as I was sent into the world, so I send them into the world. Okay? 17:21. Why doesn't somebody read 21 to the end of the... start even with 20. That'll give us a last flavor.
I do not ask in behalf of these alone, but for those also who believe in me through their word.
Okay, so the anybody that uses this as a mission text uses it validly, okay?
That they may all be one, even as thou, Father, art one in me, and I in thee, that they also may be in us, that the world may believe that thou didst send me. And the glory which thou hast given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, just as we are one. I in them, and thou in me, that they may be perfected in unity, that the world may know that thou didst send me, and didst love them, even as thou didst love me. Father, I desire that they also, whom thou hast given me, be with me where I am, in order that they may be my glory, which thou hast given me. For thou didst love me before the foundation of the world. O righteous Father, although the world has not known thee, yet I have known thee, and these have known thee that thou didst send me. And I have made thy name known to them, and will make it known, that the love wherewith thou didst love me may be in them.
Okay, now I want to, after this survey, I want to return to our text and wrestle with it. For God so loved the world that God gave the only Son, that whosoever believes in the Son should not perish but have eternal life. For God sent the Son into the world not to condemn the world, but that the world might be saved through him. How is the world saved? He who believes in him is not condemned. He who does not believe is condemned already, because this person has not believed in the name of the only Son of God. And this is the judgment, that the light has come into the world, and people love darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light, lest their deeds should be exposed. But anyone who does what is true comes to the light, that it may be clearly seen that these deeds have been wrought in God. Now we've got 20 minutes to, as a group, think about with each other, how does it hurt? How does it work in my life and in yours and the life of the church? How do we live out the tension that as disciples of Jesus, we are caught in between these two realities? God loved the world, came to save the world, gave his Son for the world, yet the world is the enemy. And I just have to say that I find in my day-to-day life it much easier to fear and hate the world than to find ways to love it. Because when I look at the lives of my kids and the life of my nation, I feel each day of my life more powerfully the enemy nature of the world. I said in the earlier session, I'm scared because I think the world is winning. Now you take it from here. How does it work?
Something that's always been helpful to me, and I can't remember the publication date, but Bill Lazarus did a study thing for the LCA back in, I think, the early 70s called In But Not Of, mm-hmm. in which he developed a kind of a three-pronged approach. There are people who live in the world and they relish living in the world and that's their whole focus. There are people who live not of the world and they remove themselves from the world and are very pious and withdrawn and they won't have anything to do with the world. But we have been asked as Christians to live in the world, but not let the world control us, being not of the world. And so that when we do that, we're going to have all the tension all the time, and it's going to be placed on us in terms of that tension. But that we know that we're not there alone. There's a sense of empowerment in knowing that we go not that road on our own, but that God indeed is with us as we go on that road. And we, as long as we know that, then there is a sense in which we can move on. Otherwise, we become overwhelmed, as I hear you're saying, and I feel from time to time. But with that knowledge, we are not overwhelmed, and we can continue the battle in a strong way.
To me, this is I think God loving the world means He loves the individuals in it. But in the passage down there, it says, "For fear that everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed." I think it's a question of the difference between people and what they do. You can love the people and not like what they do. And just like you can love the alcoholic, or you may not like the destructiveness of the alcoholic that he does. And I think that we are called to love the world and all the people in it. But that doesn't mean we accept all the behaviors that they do.
Is God's judgment of the world that comes out all through this in terms of the light, is that part of God's love for the world?
I think it says it very clearly here that God does not judge the world. The people judge themselves by the deeds.
Well, let's look at the issue of light. After I've done here and had a little coffee, I've got to go down and talk about the light of the world and I am the light of the world and I am the bread of life to the Narnia people, and I'm scared stiff. I don't know what I'm going to do. So maybe you can tell me, is light, that issue at the end of our text, the light. Some people hate that light. Some people welcome it because they are confident enough and have power enough to say, if the light shines on my deeds, these will be seen to be the deeds of God. Do we really live there, or is that oversell? And then back to, does the light judge? And then the next step is, you know, our little letter to Bush. Is that us holding our candle up to shed a little light in the Oval Office?
A word that's in a way even scarier to me than hate here is preferred darkness. And I think in my own life, if I have a bad habit, like overeating or something like that, you know, self-indulgence, somebody referred to last night, it's kind of, there's a preference there and a hanging on to something which is a preference for, in a way, darkness over light, and it's hanging on to something that I know is not the ideal or not what I should be doing, and yet for some reason, day after day, I hang on to it.
Where does the world exist? How many had to memorize Luther's Small Catechism when you were young? I did. And the older I get, the more interesting that three-part statement about the enemy becomes: the devil, the world, and my own flesh. Are those three things or one thing? Yes, ma'am.
In terms of the light judging, the prophets, if you think that the prophets are voice people of God, that is filled with judgment. It's the thought that God doesn't judge what is evil and doesn't say to us very clearly, if you grind the face of the poor, if you ignore, you know, the widow and the orphan, if you do this, if you do that, then I'm God, and angry. And that to me is judgment, and creative, wonderful judgment, because it calls us to, you almost have that juxtaposition, you know, you have, you should be doing this. I mean, Micah, what does the Lord require of thee? Very clearly, you do justice, you love mercy, and you walk humbly. But there is both the justice and the tenderness.
And are they one thing or two things, the justice and the tenderness? See, I think that's the thing that I can't get together. I can thunder at the world, and I can lift up the signs of what I think to be our crumbling as a society and so forth, like I've done in several of these. But I don't think there's really great love in my heart as I do that. Just the rage, yes.
Don't you think that most of the evil deeds that people do are destructive to the people, to so many things? It's a loving thing to hold that up. The idea that you can say to everybody, everything is okay, and that's a loving thing. Some of this codependency stuff talks about the fact that to enable a person to be destructive is a horribly unloving thing to do. The only possibility for them to change is to see that there is a problem. That's what, you can't ever escape the judgment in terms of that there is a right or wrong. If you're harming people and you're supporting a system which is harmful to people, how can that, that's a very unloving thing to do.
One of the great motifs, of course, in John is I am the truth. And truth usually hurts.
I think it gets back to the point of this thing, life is struggle. That's pain.
Yeah.
And
I don't myself like pain very much.
But I think the thing is that if you're escaping pain, in some way you're avoiding love. You know, if you avoid that struggle in some fashion, no matter how you do it, then in some way you're avoiding life, real life. You're avoiding love itself.
If we say
you're
the
separating
truth,
yourself from God.
If we say the truth, politically and sociologically and psychologically in the world, are we going to be hated?
Yeah, I think a perfect example, maybe even going down to Narnia, when we call our kids into account, I've had this happen again, and I hate you, Dad. I hate you. And there is that strong sense of hate because I have called them into account for what they're doing. What you hope for is a sense in which, because of the lasting relationship, that the love will also be seen through the hate. Okay, and that it will be overcome by the ongoing relationship.
This is hurting me more than it's hurting
you. And it's not even so much.
There's nothing phony in that too.
No, it's not even so much that as it is just the fact that they've been called into account and are not allowed to do something that we see as being very destructive.
Yeah.
And they don't want to change that. Just as we don't want to change when we've been called into account for doing something very destructive. And our immediate reaction is, I hate you for calling me into account for that. And also my young son can barely verbalize when he's been caught in an action. And he can barely admit it. I think that when you offer an apology and sorry, you've got to tell what you're sorry for. You can't just make a generic or a flip statement. And he can barely get it out of his mouth. You know, it's like we've exposed it. But it's, and I feel the same, I'm not saying that that's an example to me of how I feel when I'm exposed. Yeah. I feel like I'm going to die when people expose me often for what I really am.
Kind of continuing on the same theme, starting with the prophets and even your statement and feelings about the world, I don't see that as lack of love. I see lack of love as indifference or abandonment. And if God had abandoned the world and not come into the world or not sent the disciples back into the world, that would be the removing of involvement is lack of love, not anger, not even hatred. I mean, your son is hating you because he feels hurt because he loves you so much. I mean, that's kind of the other side of hate is the love.
That's very interesting. There's an old phrase, love and hate are close kin.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And maybe the enemy is not love and hate, but indifference.
Yeah, indifference, mm-hmm. Abandonment, rejection.
Maybe that's the issue. I think that it's you know, after last night, I raised my hand, I wanted to say something, and now I get a chance to say it, because I heard a rabbi once, shortly after the war, shortly after the Holocaust Revelations, and shortly after Bruno Bettelheim's The Forgotten Lesson of Anne Frank. And this bishop, that was an interesting Freudian slip, this rabbi worked that one through. This rabbi said, the enemy is the lethargy, the rabbis have taught us that the real enemy is the lethargy of the heart. He said, that's the real enemy. He said, and that's, picking up Bruno Bettelheim's thesis, he said, the lethargy of the heart was what allowed assimilated Jews in Germany, who were so caught up in the riches and in Germanic culture that they knew it couldn't happen to them, allowed them to walk like sheep to their gas chambers. And it was lethargy of the heart that let the Christians who knew better, let them walk right by their door to the gas chambers. And it seems to me that the motifs that we've been hitting, bumping against each other all week here, is that lethargy of the heart is a reality. And I think that's why Gail O'Day talks in her chapters here about from the comfort of slogan to the risk of experience, from the comfort of tradition to the risk of experience. The risk of experience, how do we know, how do we see? And then from the risk of experience to the gift of life. And that's back to our motif for the week. The struggle is life. And I guess if you're going to move into that struggle, and we're not done yet, I'm kind of getting sermonic again, forgive me. If you're going to really move into the tough stuff, you're never going to move alone. You're going to desperately need each other. Desperately need each other if you move into the tough stuff. We can afford individualism if we don't move into that place where the world is both the enemy who's threatening the life of my kids with its standards, with its music, with everything, and the object of God's love. Now, that sort of was a conversation stopper, forgive me.
My question, really, yeah. A little bit of thinking on that question. Why does the world hate Jesus and the disciples? And my thinking on that is that it hates Jesus. We maybe hate Jesus, maybe we, as we are part of the world, because Jesus confronts the world with the myth of what we think the world is about or what we should be, and Jesus presents a whole other reality. And so that hate is also because it's telling truth, something we don't want to hear, but it's important for us to hear. It's the myth, or having to face the crucified Lord and the people, the crucified people. The world hates that. So it's not really,
I don't really know, I'm thinking now, I don't know much about what the world thinks about me and Jesus. I know what I think about the world.
Well, Jesus said that the world loves darkness and he is the light. That would be a good reason for the world to hate Jesus.
Yeah. I don't know exactly how that helps me with my dilemma right now. I'm not thinking it through. Talk more.
Well, if he...
See, I think sometimes the world doesn't hate Jesus because we don't present the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Mm. We present the Jesus of... I hate to be polemic. Well, no, I don't hate to be polemic. We present the Jesus of the Crystal Cathedral, and we present all kinds of Jesuses that really aren't very obnoxious. See, I'm quite convinced that Jesus was a little bit obnoxious. Really quite an obnoxious person. When you read the New Testament without your piety, I don't blame people for getting angry at him. He was rude to his mother. We had that. He was, and there's a sense in which light, the light that is allowed to shine, causes offense. Yes, sir.
Well, and it seems to me that what we hate is that Jesus causes us to look at life in a different way. I mean, that he wants to turn everything upside down from what we would normally want to do in terms of our own eye-centeredness and desire to take care of ourselves. And he's saying all of a sudden, that's not where it's at. You didn't come here to be served, but to be a servant. And all of a sudden, all of that gets turned upside down, and all the values that the world has held up as being important and as being the highest point at which one can arrive in terms of leadership and power are seen as just the opposite. And that's where the hate, it seems to me, comes in, because it's awful nice to be up there to be served by others and to have all those goodies.
Let's have an honesty test right now. The black church that I go to every Sunday morning when I'm in Denver, Pastor Boyd often asks us, all those who love Jesus, raise your hand. And everybody raises their hand. All those who can shout and say hallelujah, raise their hand. I didn't, because I'm a Norwegian, so I didn't. And poor Jesse Boyd, who loves me, he said, well, Peter doesn't raise his hand, but he loves Jesus. I know he loves Jesus. Okay, I want to ask here, how many have ever hated Jesus? Raise your hand.
It's a pretty strong word.
Okay. Well, now that's a good test.
Can you soften that a little bit?
Big what?
Can you soften that a little bit?
No, not at all. Because the point is, the world is in me. The world is in me. I mean, I drove 1,300 miles here, just my wife and I, using fossil fuel. And what we're talking about here is how we're raping the world. Mm-hmm. I'm involved. We're every single one of us here. Even though we're wonderful Holden types, we're involved in the world and we love the world. Has Jesus ever been real enough for us that we hate Jesus? Get off my back.
Yeah, you often think life would be much simpler if you weren't involved with Jesus.
Exactly.
Much easier. But now here you are and you can't turn, you're caught.
Yep.
In that sense.
I don't know where that leads us, but that came to me. Yes.
I've heard Phyllis quote this, love mercy, do justice, and walk humbly with our Lord. I think every time I've seen her this week.
And I appreciate that.
Because that has, I think, really tied together with this idea of struggle that we've encountered in every other session this week. In order to love mercy, I have to struggle with myself and with the issues I face to find out how in the world do I love mercy. I have to struggle in order to see how to do justice.
Boy, do you ever.
And I have to struggle with my own nature to walk humbly with my Lord. And I think all of these things, we have to, if we are not willing to engage in that struggle, that is walking in darkness.
And that is walking away from life.
Yeah.
That's quick. You had the last word. Next time it's Friends for Life. What it really means to be pro-life.